All righty, we are studying the book of Genesis, and I'm on page 32. Adam and Eve have fallen. God has come into the garden. They've hidden themselves from God. And God calls out to them, asks them to reveal themselves. They do. And they said, "Why are you hiding?" He said, "Well, because we heard the voice of you in the garden. We were naked and we were ashamed." And he said, "Who told you you were naked?" Satan had told them that if they would disobey God and eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that they would know more and be like God. And that was a good thing. It turned out not to be such a good thing. Hey, Satan always lies, and there's always a hook in what he says that he's going to give us. So, all right, Genesis 3:17. "Then to Adam," that's God, said, "because you've listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat from it,' then cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat the bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." When we talked about this before, but when you look at these sentences here, these pronouncements in the Hebrew, they don't read quite the same as they do in some English translations. And this one here reads a little better than a lot of them do, because you get the impression that when God saw that they had fallen or whatever, that he was angry and mean and vengeful and whatever. And he said, "Because I'm angry at you, I'm going to dump on you. I'm going to make your labor hard. I'm going to make your childbirth hard. For your men, I'm going to make your labor at work hard," that sort of thing. "Because I'm just really angry and upset with you. You've ticked me off, for lack of a better term, and therefore I'm going to penalize you." And that's actually not what the Hebrew says at all. We've talked about this before. Hebrew is a language that has no tenses for its verbs. It has nine aspects. And when you study Hebrew, you have to understand if it's nifal or puel, what the aspect is, because the aspect tells you what the tone of the words mean. And these statements that he's making here are predictive statements. They're not prescriptive statements. In other words, he's not saying, "I'm angry and therefore I'm going to dump on you." He is saying, because you've fallen, these are the natural consequences of what will happen. God is actually quite disappointed and unhappy that his children are going to have to go through all of this, because that's not what he created them for. He created them to be able to share in his kingdom, to share in the whole life of God that the Trinity shared among themselves. He created them the same reason you create your own children, for good. He created them for joy. He created them to be able to enjoy all that you have, that you might be able to share that with them and pass it down to the generations. And they've gone and messed it up, and he's not happy that they've gone and messed it up. Not because he's mad at them because they screwed up his plan, but because he knew they were going to do that, but because he knows their life is going to be difficult because of it. Jesus is constantly reminding us that he and the Lord are one. He and the Father are one. And if you've seen the Father, you've seen me. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And so the same motivations and behaviors that we see in Jesus are the ones that are in the Father. And anything else other than that is just a lie from the enemy. There's a lot of reasons why these translations come across the way they do. Part of it is because after the Reformation, we began to get a very twisted view of God based on the Reformation, of God being mean, vindictive, bitter, self-centered, and just an overall jerk. But that's not who the Bible tells us God is. Jesus says, "Which of you who has a son would give him who asked for a fish would give him a snake? Or he asked for a loaf of bread, would give him a rock. Or if he asked for an egg, would give him a scorpion. If you who are corrupted by sin know how to give good gifts to your children, then how much more will the Heavenly Father give gifts to his children?" Jesus is telling us that the motivations of God are good. God is good all the time. All the time, God is good. We say that, and yet sometimes the way we read these things, we don't really believe it. We think of God as mean, bitter, vindictive, whatever. And He's not. God never disciplines us without the intention of restoring us, if at all possible. So, Hebrews 12 is the great New Testament chapter on the discipline of God. We have Hebrews 11, which talks about faith and the people who approach God by faith, and it's impossible to please God without faith. But then Hebrews 12 talks about God's discipline. It jumps right in and says, well, why does God discipline His children? What should we understand from all of that if God is loving? And he says all discipline for the moment seems difficult, but later it produces the peaceable fruits of righteousness. So when you discipline your children, when you're in the right frame of mind, you discipline them so they will learn something, so that they will grow from this, and so they will do the right things going forward, so that you can teach them to avoid trouble, you can teach them to become successful people. Your motivations are good. They don't always see it that way. Sometimes your children, especially your little children, are just absolutely sure that you're mean, vindictive, bitter, don't care about anything, and that you're hateful, whatever. But you know who you are and what you're about and what that's all about. And Jesus says, if we know how to discipline our children for their good, then how much more the Heavenly Father, whose whole structure morally and ethically is much higher than ours. In Hebrews it says, our fathers, they disciplined us at their pleasure. They did it because they wanted to. They did it because it seemed good to them. Said, how much more the Heavenly Father, when He disciplines us, He's the giver of life, and He disciplines us that we might have life and life more abundantly. We're told clearly what the motivation of God is. Now, when God gives man free will, He knows that some of us are going to resist Him. We're going to walk the wrong way. And then He knows that some of us are going to do it forever. He knows that some of us are going to turn against God and are never going to come home. And He knows that. But there's not a lot He can do about that if He wants to give us the opportunity to walk with Him, to learn, to grow, to choose, to share eternity with Him. You can't give somebody upside choices without giving them downside choices, or you've just made them puppets again, and there's no glory in that for anybody. So He said here, the ground becomes cursed because of Adam and not because of God. Adam is the steward of the earth. It is his ministry. And, you know, if I am the steward of a business and I goof it up, then everybody in the business gets hurt. If I am the head of the steward of a family, whether I'm mother or father, and I goof all that up, then the family gets hurt. There's a downside gravitational consequence to the bad behavior of whoever is the steward. God is not mean, He's just other. He is trying to tell us how we ought to live, what we ought to do. And this information about the ground being cursed because of you is description. He's saying, I'm sorry, this is what's going to happen. The creation will no longer work like it was designed. It gets out of balance and off kilter. Weeds, thorns, and thistles grow up unregulated by man. When man begins to no longer be obedient, no longer care for the garden, it begins to unravel and become problematic. If we look at it with any kind of eyes at all, we can see that our world has suffered because of the abuse of the world by man. That man has done a great deal to damage this world, and that God is going to have to fix it someday on a miraculous level, which is what the second coming is all about. And we are told in New Testament that in Romans that Paul says that the whole creation groans because it's been subjected to futility. It doesn't work like it's supposed to anymore. You know, when we had the flood and God had to do all of that, he had to, you know, the tectonic plate shifted, it ripped the earth apart. We had seven huge valleys for oceans. We have seven continents. And everything works differently. The rakia was destroyed, the rain cycles began, and the earth has been badly treated, has badly suffered because of the poor stewardship of man, the sin of man, fall of man. And he's saying that, cursed is the ground because of you. The Bible tells us in Romans, Paul said that the earth groans like a woman in labor, awaiting the manifestation of the sons of God, that is the resurrection of their bodies. The earth is waiting for man to become restored into the Adamic pre-fall nature, because at that particular point in time, it's going to be restored. It's going to work right again. And when we study all of the end time wording or verbiage about Jesus coming back and restoring the earth and creating the garden and the trees and the rivers being come, pollution is driven out and the rivers become healthy again, and the trees grow up and bear fruit, and all of the garden is restored. That happens at the second coming, which is the point at which mankind receives their glorified bodies again. Because of various misuses of and disobediences on our part, bacteria and viruses proliferate. As metabolism goes awry, that becomes genetically passed on and mutated, and it just gets to be a bigger and bigger mess. Creation becomes futile, broken, and run amok. Man was still forbidden to eat the animals, but they did not obey, resulting in diseases and physical problems new to mankind. The death of the animals was never intended. Then after the fall, the death of the animals was meant to demonstrate the nature of sin, and as an offering to God for our sin. The man figured out pretty quickly that smells good. It's like if you need to walk around behind the KFC or the rib shop, that smells good. And man began to violate the prohibition against eating animals, and that brought on other issues. We know that in the millennial reign we will not eat the animals as a rule. So the diseases and physical problems began to proliferate, genetically mutate, and pass on down to what we have. When our bodies die, they return to dust because our eternal spirits have left us at the fall. Now, man was not meant to die. He was meant to live forever. But once Adam sinned, the spirit left him, and the body began to diminish. And diminishment of the body is just a process of death. All of this gray hair and pieces and parts that are missing and stuff that doesn't work right is just death in action, just slow death, as it were. And therefore, everything goes south. We will return to the dust from which we were made. All of this will be reversed for the believers at the second coming. Now, the man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all the living. And the Lord made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. All right. So the consequences of the fall begin immediately. Everywhere, barriers are erected and fellowship declines because of the fall. The wrestling for preeminence again begins. Man and wife struggling for control over each other. Adam renames Eve as his domestic. She was Isha, his lover. Now she is Eve, mother of all things. And this is not an M is for the most, you know, an O is for the other. This is like your role is to be the mother. He names her for her domestic role as opposed to this term that he had called her before, because he's trying to exercise control over her, put her in her place. The first animals slain were killed by the hand of God in order to provide clothing for Adam and Eve. Because man sins, animals have to die. Didn't happen before that. Adam sins, animals pay for it. Fear and dread enter into the man-animal relationship. The animals had no reason to fear man for this. There was collegiality with the animals and mankind. Nowhere, for instance, are we told that Eve goes home and said, "You won't believe this, but a snake talked to me today." The reaction that we see with all of this is that was expected. In other words, there was a communication between man and animals that did not surprise Eve when the snake began to talk to her.
Were animals all vegetarians?
The animals were vegetarians. Remember that what happens in the millennial reign is that the lion will eat straw like the ox. So nobody's doing that. Relationship and childbirth become more, let's see here, and barriers are erected, and fellowship, let's see, I skipped some. Adam sins and the earth pays for it. The earth is subjected to fertility. Barriers are erected and fellowship declines. Adam sin and Eve pays for it. Relationship and childbirth become more difficult. Barriers are erected and fellowship declines. Adam sin and mankind pays for it. Man's labors become more difficult. Maintaining health and life itself becomes difficult. His relationship with God becomes more difficult. His relationship with others become more difficult. Barriers are erected and fellowship declines. Later when we see the flood, we see that it's very difficult now because you've got to go over oceans and mountains to get to one another as opposed to Pangaea, which made it easy for us to go back and forth. But now, because of what happened with the flood and God's requirement to deal with all of that, barriers are erected and fellowship declines. All salvation is about relationship. And all damnation is about the destruction of relationship. So we see that that's the result of sin. And the Lord said, God said, behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore, God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to cultivate the ground from which he was taken. So he drove the man out. At the east of the Garden of Eden, he stationed the cherubim, the flaming sword which turned in every direction to guard the way of the tree of life. So the tree of life now becomes dangerous to Adam and Eve. The tree of eternal life, if they ate from that tree, would cause them to live forever and never die. Adam and Eve are becoming progressively more corrupted, physically corrupted, morally corrupted, ethically, emotionally corrupted, and mankind goes along, it gets worse and worse and worse. And as an individual person ages, they get worse and worse and worse. And were we to become eternal in that corrupted state, that would be the definition of hell. Because what happened is we're getting worse and worse and worse, and yet we can't die. We can't get out of it. Death is actually man's friend because it releases man from the ravages of the fallen nature and from sin. It gives us a chance to get out of this shell that's getting worse and worse and worse. Yes?
I was going to ask this last week, but I'm just the thing that's stupefied. How could Moses know all this stuff? Just come to him in Revelation, or
that's the way any of us know all this stuff. As far as the historical thing goes, these people are passing their history down by Toledots, just like all.
Right.
As far as God's thinking and all that, that's God. That's Revelation. How do any of us know anything? We know it by Revelation because God reveals it to us. You know, I mean, you take a rookie sales guy into a call or something like that, he says all the wrong things.
Right.
You know, and he thinks, no, this is probably the right way to do this, you know. And you know better because you have revelation as to how it all work. What you try to do is to impart knowledge to him. Hopefully he gets the revelation. If he doesn't, then he winds up being somebody else's salesman because he's counterproductive. That's what's going on. So what Moses knew, he knew because God showed it to him. And you have to remember that Moses and God had levels of fellowship that were beyond what we have. You know, they were face-to-face friends. I mean, they were not face-to-face friends, but they were very close personal friends, and there was a lot of time there and a lot of conversation. And the truth of the matter is the more relationship we have with God, the more we understand things also.
Of course, it makes you more.
Yeah, so that's how he could know. It's a great question, but that's the answer. So God says, you know, we've got to do something here. We cannot afford to let this progressively corrupting man whom we love become eternal as progressively and corrupting. We've got to get him out of this world and get him the chance to get the new body, start over, the new born-again experience, the life experience. Otherwise, they would be bad. So we have, he had to bar us from that particular place. Probably, if we think about this, there's some place where your children would love to go, and it's only destroying them. And so you get to the place after a while where you say, we need to keep them from going to that place because it's only making them worse and worse and worse. When you do that, they're going to think that you are bad, mean, evil, ruining their fun, all of that sort of thing. But you know that you're doing that so that they actually have a chance to survive. So God takes these two angels and he positions them at the garden, and he sends man out of the garden into the world to go out and try to raise his crop and his food in there. Remember, in the garden, this stuff is almost voluntary. It is the way it comes up. And then we know, for instance, that the garden is taken away because it's no longer there. We see the parallels of Jesus taking the people from out of Sheol up and approaching the gates of heaven. And there they are, those two angels who are the barrier angels. There they are to open these gates so that man might come in. So the general thinking is that Eden goes to heaven. Now we also know at the second coming that it's coming back down. It's coming back down. The new Jerusalem coming out of heaven that comes back down to earth. So we'll get a chance to do this again. Now, to live in a progressively corruptive state and to live that way forever is a good definition of hell. To get worse and worse and worse. Some of us have been around people enough to know that there comes a point when people want to go be with the Lord, because to stay here is just too much trouble. It's just too hard. And so what happens is that we can get a glimpse for what it would be like if instead of that happening, we just continued on and it got even worse and worse and worse. I've talked to you before about a movie called What Dreams May Come. It's a Robin Williams movie. Cuba Gooding Jr., Max von Sydow, several others in that movie. And it is it's actually made based on a Jewish philosophy of the afterlife. It's a pretty good movie, except for the last 2 minutes. Don't listen to the last 2 minutes. But anyway, the point of it is that it's all about somebody dying and going to heaven and having a loved one that died and went to hell, and there's a comparison between the two and a whole bunch of stuff that goes on there. But in this particular movie, one of the things we see is that people, this lady who went to hell was almost like going into an Alzheimer's state where she not only couldn't, you know, think or remember right or whatever, but she was miserable with the whole thing. And in the movie, we see a very redemptive scene where the person who went to heaven lays down their life to save the one who went to hell, whatever. It's an interesting portrayal of heaven and hell. It's not biblical all the way through, but I recommend it to you because it gives you a feel for what hell would be like if it wasn't like, you know, griddle on the toast and on the fire and all this kind of stuff. It's just despair. It's, huh?
What was the name of it again?
What Dreams May Come. What Dreams May Come. And you might want to write that down. What Dreams May Come. And it's Robin Williams is whose movie it is. It's got some interesting concepts in it. So, you know that in Psalm 116, and I quote this a lot at funerals, but in Psalm 116 it says that God rejoices at the death of his loved ones. He rejoices at the death of his loved ones. Now, we're not always rejoicing, but he does, because they're coming home. They're getting set free. They're being delivered from all of this that's here. God sees the passing of his beloved ones as graduation. They're coming home. And, you know, you can almost think about some child who's gone off to Afghanistan or one of these wars, and they're in this horrible environment and danger all around and wounded and all this sort of thing. And then they come home, you know, the joy that people have. So God's point of view is that when one of his loved ones come home, it is a time of great rejoicing. In the church where Nancy and I met the Lord, we used to have what we called going home celebrations, because the old saints in our environment are the people we had. Our theology was is that death was our friend, that to go and be with the Lord. Paul said, I can stay here or I can go there. He said, you know, to be with Christ is better for me. To be with you is better for you. So I'll stay here a little longer for your sake. But I'd much rather be with Christ. That's better. And John Wesley said, good Methodists die well. He could have said, good Christians die well. He means that we should not be afraid to die. In fact, I wrote a blog on that about why we should not be afraid to die. It was an issue with John Wesley personally that he went through for many years until he got some insight on it. Now, this is the place where I usually talk about puppet, puppy, and pal. And all of you have heard this, right? Yeah. So I'm just going to point out just briefly that in order for us to have free will, we have to have the ability to do the wrong thing as much as the ability to do the right thing. And anything other than that, like a forced ability to do the right thing, but not the wrong thing, is a theological and philosophical nonsense. Puppets can be made to do whatever you want, and you could create it. God could have created a bunch of puppets and just made them do the right thing. The problem is it's not very satisfying as you go along. Puppets can't hurt you, but they also can't really bless you, because that's your hand in the puppet. You know, I mean, you're destroyed. It's just self-love. It's what it is. So you move up to a puppy, because a puppy is reciprocal, and their love for you, and they lick your face, and they lick your feet, and they go get the ball. And they become your friend. I wanted, you know, to mention to you all that we found Rufus the cat. You all maybe remember last week. My son moved, and the day he moved, the cat got out, and they moved to a different place, and this is a beloved cat. It's the best cat I've ever known. This cat will come get in your lap and lick your face like a dog. I mean, I've never seen a cat like this. His name was Rufus. And we loved him, but they loved him a lot. And so they lost Rufus. Well, they had moved. So if Rufus came home, what do you do? And so they had flyers up everywhere, and they kept going back to the old neighborhood and whatever. And 2 weeks he was gone, and my granddaughter found him day before yesterday. We haven't heard exactly how yet. But Rufus is home, and great is the joy of it. You know, and I can just sort of imagine when Jade, my granddaughter, and Rufus saw each other, just the sheer joy of that. Rufus has, you know, been out scrounging on his own, trying to make it, you know, trying to avoid the foxes and the wildcats and stuff in that area, feed where he can feed. So, and then, of course, they've been missing Rufus. So they found Rufus. It's great as the joy of it. So the point is that a puppy has the ability to return love to you in ways that are very, very satisfying, more than a puppet. But a puppy can also hurt you, or, you know, because they can die, or they can leave little unwanted offerings on your carpet, or they can chew your the furniture up. Or they can get lost and break your heart because they have that, because of the way that they are. The reciprocity that's embedded in them gives you more joy, but also can cause you more pain. But then they become unsatisfactory at some levels, because you can't marry a puppy. You can't marry a cat, you know. So what happens is you move up to a pal or a friend. Now, another human being has the capacity to love you and make you happy, much more so than a puppy could, or a puppet, or whatever. They have the ability to reciprocate at a much more intelligent level. And they can, you know, I've been married 46 years, and it has been a relationship of extraordinary, you know, joy, whatever. There have been times, of course, but they're historic. But a person, they can bless you in ways that a puppy cannot. They can also hurt you in ways that a person cannot. And when we have a person or a pal, that relationship, it begets the greatest joy, but it can also beget the greatest pain and hurt. So many of us have experienced some of that as well, the betrayal that can happen and go on there. And God is in the same boat. God wanted to have children. He wanted to have friends. And he had to give them the ability to choose him voluntarily, to walk with him, to reciprocate, and with one comes the other. So God, he can't create a philosophical nonsense, can't create a square circle. So he gave us free will, and free will, the abuse of free will, is what causes all the evil in this world. And that's just, it's just something that goes with it. The abuse of man's free will caused the earth to be harmed. It caused the animal kingdom to be harmed. It caused the relationship between themselves to be harmed. All of these things were the result of that. That's what Genesis 3 is telling us. Comments. Genesis 4. Now the man had relationships with Eve, his wife, and she even gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Eve had daughters, which we'll see in just a minute. They're down here. Probably before she had sons. Cain and Seth and Abel had to marry someone. And Adam and Eve are the parents of us all. Then they had to be the parents of their sons' wives as well, at least in the very beginning. The societal prohibition against a man marrying his sister was not established until relatively recent times. I mean, the last 100 years or so. The genetics were not problematic at the level that they are now. And so for many, many, many generations of mankind, thousands and thousands of years, men married their sisters, sisters married their brothers, etc. And in the beginning, it was an absolute necessity. Now I'm from Kentucky, so we're used to this. And we always felt like, why would we want somebody from some other person's family? If she isn't good enough for them, why would we want them? You know? And we always had the moral dilemma, if your mom and your dad get divorced, are they still your aunt and your uncle? Okay. Yes. You have a question?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it. What you just said about genetics.
Yes.
Well, I don't get that.
Well, as time has gone on, it's become genetically problematic for people to marry that close because you begin to have... Yeah, problems, mental issues, physical issues, whatever.
So why wasn't that the case?
Because the genetics are much worse than they were now. Back in those days, the genetics were all clean and pure. We hadn't started... Our genetic stream has gotten very polluted by all kinds of things, including all the bacteria and stuff that we have. There was at one time no genetics to create Down syndrome, but it was created. It was created among us. There are all manner of things that were not genetically happening then that are happening now because of the way the gene pool coming together has created some toxic soup. Okay? So
see, the DNA, the chromosomes, they mutated, and if you married somebody close, it was more likely you would get something dominant.
That's why Bob's the way he is.
Yeah.
The mutation is the good word for this because as we've gone along, it's all been changed inside, and it creates problems. Yes.
Just look at something like the flu and penicillin. No use of penicillin anymore because all those viruses have gotten through. Oops, we know that that's become nectar instead of poison.
Yeah. 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 So I mean, even the viruses and stuff that we developed did not exist in the beginning. I mean, Adam and Eve took 800-900 years to die. So did their immediate offspring, and that began to diminish as time went on because genetically we began to become diminished. After the flood, in particular, when the Rakia is gone, it drops like a rock, but it's still 300 years, 200 years, whatever. And just over time, it becomes difficult for us to sustain that kind of life. The world becomes dangerous in lots of ways. Bacteria proliferate. I mean, there was a time in our lifetime when there was no HIV. That was created in our lifetime. It wasn't there. So that would be true of almost anything else that's out there, like smallpox and all that. All of that wasn't, and then it was because of genetic mutation. Societal prohibitions against marrying his sisters were not established until relatively recent times. I mean, talking about the last 100, 200 years. For instance, King David's daughter Tamar reminded King David's son Amnon that they could be married so as to legitimize his sexual approaches to her. There was no problem with them marrying each other just because they were brother and sister, even in that particular time frame, as late as King David. Now, in Genesis 4:1, we read this, says, the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain, and she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. What this saying is saying in the Hebrew is I've gotten a child, and this one's a man. This one's a man. And the implication in the way it's said is I've had woman children, this one's a man. The way it's emphasized in the writing. In Genesis 5:4 it says, the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years or whatever, and he had other sons and daughters. So we're told that Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters besides Cain, Abel, and Seth. Remember, we talked about as we study the Bible, and the history is the story from Adam to Jesus. That's his story. And the Bible is like a frozen section all the way back from here to there. And it doesn't mention whole groups of peoples outside of the main line, the Toledot line, from Adam through to Christ. We get stories from time to time about people who live out there, like Job, who was a contemporary of Abraham but did not flow in Abraham's line. Or Jethro, the priest of Midian, who did not flow in that particular line. He was a descendant of Abraham, but not through Isaac, and therefore didn't make the story, except as it relates to the fact that he taught Moses how to know who God was. So there are in the Bible stories of other peoples besides the main line, but they always show up in the Bible as modifiers or to explain things going on in the main line. So we're told Adam and Eve had other sons and daughters besides the three that are mentioned. And I suppose if you're around for 900 years, you could have a lot of those. Genesis 4:3. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. And Abel on his part also brought the firstlings of his flock, their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. Now, all this is saying is God liked Abel's offering and did not like Cain's. You know, I mean, you know, we're in our society, you know, if I give you a gift, you're supposed to like it, right? That's just wonderful, hon. What I really wanted was a new set of snow tires for our anniversary. That's just wonderful, you know, or whatever. Or, gee, another tie, you know, or whatever. Or, you know, somebody gives you this, you know, like, oh, a gut be gone. You remember that old commercial? There's this thing that they used to advertise called a gut be gone. Well, it was actually a Saturday Night Live takeoff on it. There was this thing you wore around, and there was this woman, and she was sitting next to this bulbous husband, you know. And they had just handed a gift to this guy. And he says, it's a gut be gone. He said, Marvin loves his, you know. So, is this a device? So, at any rate, we're all supposed to act like we just love what everybody else gives us. We tend to ask each other what it is you want, as opposed to, unless I really know what she wants, I don't... So we're supposed to give people what they want. Well, at any rate, God said, this is what I want by way of sacrifice. I want the sacrifice of a lamb. And Cain came along with a sacrifice of fruits and vegetables. Cain was a farmer. Abel was a tiller, was a keeper of sheep. And God, because he's God, has more wisdom than we do. And he wanted this image of the sacrificed lamb embedded in our minds concerning the wages of sin and all that sort of thing, because he was setting us up to understand Jesus. And Abel, or Cain, who brought these fruits and vegetables to God, in all likelihood was bringing his very best. There's nothing that says it was bad fruit and vegetables. It's just it wasn't what God wanted. And we can see from some of the language here. Or he liked Abel's, but he didn't like Cain's. Had regard for them. So Cain became angry, and his countenance fell. He got upset, and he showed up on his face. I used to tell my children needed to get happy, and they go, well, I'm happy. And I say, well, if you're happy, let your face know it. The point is that they Cain was, he took it as a personal rejection because God did not accept his offering, didn't like it, didn't like his present. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? Why are you going around with that lip on, you know? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? You know, if you do the right thing, I'll be happy to accept it. I have nothing against you. I'm just teaching you, do the right thing. Go take all those good fruits and vegetables, buy a lamb off your brother Abel, come back and offer the lamb, and we're hunky-dory. You've learned obedience. You've learned something that's important for me to teach all of you all about what it means for sin to be redeemed through the death of the lamb. If you do not do well, he said, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. If you don't do the right thing and you get all upset when it's not accepted, you got to remember sin is crouching at your door and it's trying to capture you. This whole sense of being angry and upset is the devil trying to capture you with this bitterness, this root of bitterness. Remember, the Bible says in the New Testament that we should not allow a root of bitterness to enter into us because by it, it says, many are defiled and some have been destroyed. So we should not do that. He says, just learn from this. Go get yourself a sheep. I don't know if Cain and Abel were friends. That's obvious as we go along here. I don't know why Cain didn't just bargain for it. Maybe he just didn't get the memo. Or, you know, he just didn't want to do that. Maybe he didn't want to have to go suck up to Abel to get a lamb. Who knows what the reason was? He didn't. And God said, that ain't the way to do it, son. And so Cain told Abel his brother, and it came about that when they were afield that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and they killed him. They had been brothers side by side. They were friendly. They were getting along. There was no animosity with them. And after Cain gets all upset and kills his brother, he regrets it, deeply regrets what he has done. Just got his temper out of control. The first murder is preceded by covetousness, which is the gateway sin. It's the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet, but it's the gateway to all sin. Because Cain wanted what Abel had, it led to murder. God's acceptance in this case. Lucifer coveted the seat at the right hand of the Father. And we've read Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28 a number of times. Adam and Eve coveted God's knowledge and wisdom. Cain coveted Abel's relationship with and approval from God. Satan coveted mastery over men, which was reserved for King Jesus. Sin crouches at the door when we covet, when we go seeking after that which God is not ready to give us yet or at all. There are things here that are not told directly in the text, but we can discern them. God required the flesh of animals as sacrifice. He killed the first two animals ever slain to provide clothing for Adam and Eve, who now need covering because of their sin. Abel's sacrifice of a lamb was acceptable. Cain's sacrifice of his vegetable harvest was unacceptable. We're not told why, only that it was unacceptable. There's no reason to think it was bad vegetables or that God was angry with Cain for something else and therefore did not want his sacrifice. There's no implication here that Cain had sinned and that's why God turned away his sacrifice. He said, you do the right thing, you'll be accepted. It wasn't like he was mad about that. Talk about the lamb as a symbol or a metaphor for the innocent and the willing sacrifice. God was probably preparing us to understand the atoning death of Jesus by using the lamb as his metaphor, even back here in the beginning of time. God is constantly using Old Testament metaphors to point to New Testament understanding. The bread and wine of the grain offering pointed to the Lord's Supper. Passing through the Red Sea pointed to baptism. The scapegoat pointing to the atoning work of Jesus on the cross. There are additionally two other things to notice here. God and men are still conversing after the fall. After the fall, God and man are still talking to one another. The voice of God has not abandoned them, even though there's been the fall. And Cain and Abel were friends.
How do you see that Cain and Abel were friends when it says...
Well, because they were together in the field, with each other, and then Cain rose up and killed him out of his anger. There's no suggestion here that Abel was afraid of him or whatever. And then later, of course, we're going to see here in a minute that he feels guilty over the thing. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" And he said, "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my neighbor's keeper? Must I love my neighbor?" He's going right at the heart of commandment number 2, neighbor. And he said, of course, he was sort of violating neighbor when he killed him. You know, that was... He said to him, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." This is a really good example of parts of speech and action in the Bible. The voice of the blood is crying to me from the ground. It's a metaphor. You know, we get into these metaphors sometimes, and people want to treat them as if they're like a scientific statement. We're not to assume that Abel's blood was suddenly crying out with a voice. It's a metaphor here. "And now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you've cultivated the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth," which is hard on farmers, by the way. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is too great to bear. Behold, thou hast driven me this day from the face of the ground. From thy face I shall be hidden. I shall be made a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. It shall come about that whoever finds me will kill me." So the Lord said to him, "Whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, lest anyone finding him should slay him. He marked him in some way. And so that people would be afraid of him. You know, maybe he just began to have a visage that was just scary and people stayed away from him. You know, like the biker or whatever that you run into, turns out to be a nice guy, but looks like he might kill you. The murder changed or corrupted Cain's heart and his countenance. It also dramatically affected his lifestyle and the well-being of his family. You cannot be a successful farmer if you are a vagrant and a wanderer. Abel's murder was a violation of the second great commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. Cain's question, "Am I my brother's neighbor?" is merely rhetorical. Of course he is your brother's neighbor. The violation of the second commandment is the abuse and neglect of your neighbor, and the penalty for that in violation is embedded in the principle of sowing and reaping. Whatever you do to others will be done unto you. Cain's innate fear was that whatever he had done to Abel would be done unto him, demonstrating that moral law is a part of our conscience and embedded in us all. Comments here. Okay, somebody pray us out.